So this is going to be part two of our analysis of Elena Lamberti's amazing book, Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic, where for the first time you hear people, you have a person write out and explaining the modernist or men of 1914 roots, Vortices roots of McLuhan's method in the 50s and 60s, what I call early McLuhan. I'm not going to keep harping on that this does not apply to later McLuhan, but we're going to do early McLuhan here, before the Global Theater wiped out any vestige of the Gutenberg culture or any legacy of criticism from Cambridge University or modernist aesthetics. It was all irrelevant once you had Planet of the Dead. And if you notice, on Andrew McLuhan, McLuhan's grandson, his site, the McLuhan Institute, they're featuring stuff from their family archives. And they had a table with a bunch of magazine articles on McLuhan and some Innes Herald put out by the Innes College, edited by Carl Scarf. On the table, you could see an Innes Herald that I have, and it says on the title, on the cover image, Planet of the Dead. And that's what that's what McLuhan was talking about in the 70s, and it's right there in that particular copy of the Innes Herald. So if anybody's got 50 bucks, 40, 30 bucks, or something like that, call up Andrew and buy that copy. I think it's still available. I didn't buy it. All right. All right, Carol. Well, so that's our introduction. Carol's going to go through and pick out quotes that she liked. Carol says this book is what, Carol? You want to say something about the book?
Well, basically, I have fallen in love with Elena. Last week, I was a little hesitant. I was wondering about this humanistic front that she had, that she thought McLuhan was just being a humanist, but Bob and I think it's much more. But what happens as I keep reading, because I'd only read 10%, I'm doing it on Kindle last week, and now I'm up to, whatever, 20%, and she's really able to take all of McLuhan's words, his cliches, his archetypes, she's able to take that and apply it and explain in a way that's almost poetic sometimes, but not overly. She's a good prose writer, and she's basically a teacher. So it's really a pleasure to read. And hopefully Bob won't go off into huge digressions this week, and we'll get through some more quotes. I'm only on page 13.
All right. Did everybody hear Carolyn?
Yes.
Yeah. I just found it sounded a little bit distant. But no, you're coming through clear. Okay, Carolyn.
So this sentence is on page 13. Bob usually likes to follow, but he's not running to his book yet. But as soon as he...
Oh, shit. I got to get the book, don't I?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I could try the quote. I might know
okay.
it.
Okay. When reading McLuhan, form is as important as content, just as it is when we read Joyce, Pound, Eliot, or Lewis. Translating that into McLuhanese, we could say that the medium is the message. So she's using the literary content of these writers and McLuhan putting it into his form and calling that the medium is the message. Is that correct, Bob?
Yes, the broadest level is you're reading a book, and he wants you to be aware of his ideas being filtered through the book effect. So the first level of the medium being the message, okay, I'm reading McLuhan via book. That's not all of McLuhan. This is McLuhan through the book. And then the next level is the content, and because the modernists, Lewis, Joyce, Eliot, and Pound were constantly writing their poetry and prose and essays and interviews with the media environment of their day in mind, they had to adapt their Gutenberg arts to the electronic or Marconi effect. So McLuhan continued that tradition of writing a discontinuous multi-level prose not equitone, which was the normal Gutenberg monotone, he would imitate their style to mirror the electric media environment around him. It had to be discontinuous like electricity or tactile acoustic space. So there was the broader, the medium is the message. Okay, McLuhan's saying, I've found a way to revitalize books. So just the fact you bought this book, an experienced book, is good because you got too much TV and global theater happening to you, and you have lost your ability to have perspective. Okay, so now I made you buy the book. Now, notice it's difficult to read. It's in a discontinuous, odd style, which today, when I go back and read it, it's real simple to read, but apparently it upset everybody. They couldn't make sense out of what McLuhan was saying in a paragraph. It wasn't an academic book with footnotes, and didn't have the same kind of chapter headings. So the whole style was derivative of Pound's Cantos, Joyce's Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, Eliot's The Wasteland, and Lewis's, say, The Art of Being Ruled or The Eights of God. So he was revitalizing the modernist breakthroughs. And there is a guy named Glenn Wilmot, a Canadian professor, who did a book on McLuhan called Modernism in Reverse. I don't know if Lamberti would consider her, she would agree that McLuhan was modernism in reverse. He was just updating and redoing modernism, not necessarily in reverse. But she does think highly of Wilmot's book anyways.
Well, in reverse implies that he's picking up on the older authors and bringing them into the present, and she calls it mosaic or field approach, and that brings up the next
That's
quote.
What McLuhan called it.
Well, yeah, he does, but she focuses on describing his approach all the time as being mosaic.
Which was all the techniques of the modernists, of the men of 1914, say.
Yes.
The mosaic was a term that everybody, journalists would say, oh, McLuhan writes in a mosaic, but they didn't know the mosaic method. They thought that McLuhan invented it. They didn't have enough literary knowledge, history, to know that he was redoing the modernists.
That's
her point, her main point.
Yeah, and the most people could say about him was, oh, he's just describing Joyce, or they wanted to...
No, they didn't know that.
Focus on one person.
No, people didn't know that.
You know how they say, who was your source? And they try to narrow it down and say, well, maybe it's Joyce.
I'm talking about the journalistic response, sort of the average response. Everybody thought he was an alien, a Martian.
Right.
They didn't know modernist literature. I mean, Joyce was suppressed up till the 50s. So they didn't know his antecedents. So they just thought he was a freak. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So her book at this time, because Lewis is even coming to the fore, so people can understand his sources.
Now they can. Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
So that's why the book is good right now. Okay, can I go on?
I was just thinking. Don Thiel explains this back in 71 in his book. You know, Lamberti's like in her 40s or 50s, so she's Generation X. They don't know, they don't teach Joyce that much, apparently, in university. The feminists took over, and they definitely wouldn't teach Lewis. Mm. So a lot of these sources, Lamberti's generation knows nothing about, unless they just happen to specialize in an odd individual. So she's bringing back all this stuff. It's forgotten knowledge for her generation.
Yeah, good point.
Even though Thiel did it 40, almost 50 years ago in 71, but nobody reads Thiel, you know. It's long gone.
Mm-hmm.
This is a homeopathic replay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're going to get to a point where her book and a subsequent book by Jessica Pressman called Digital Modernism, the digital is usually called postmodernism, but she makes this ironic title, Digital Modernism, and takes the same theme as Lamberti, knows of Lamberti's book, does it after Lamberti's book in 2014, shows how if you want to understand the electric media and electronic world, the digital world, you've got to go back to the men of 1914, like McLuhan did. And so she's replaying it. But as I read her book and Lamberti before, they are supporting my chart, because that's exactly what my chart is. Take the LaRouche quadrant. I have LaRouche as a replay of Ezra Pound, and Ezra Pound is replayed by radio. So I have the media itself redoing the Men of 1914. So radio does Pound, TV does Lewis, computers do William Irwin Thompson, and the Android meme does Yates, and then Dobbs does Joyce, which reminds me, Thompson. Oh, I told you about that, Fantasia. So I now have academic. Do you understand this, Carol? I don't know if you know enough about my chart. That
this you've been telling me.
I'll be able to go on
a week now
to the Lance, to the
Lance
Peskis
Drake
blog. Uh-huh. And tell them I have academic support, and what's her name, Pressman and Lamberti are trying to start a humanist retrieval movement in academic studies.
Mm-hmm.
I am the father of that fucking movement with my chart done in 95. So,
good luck, Bob.
Good luck, she says. You hear that?
Good luck with that. Okay, next quote, page 14. Literature and the arts, in fact, constitute a sort of constant fil rouge, and the translation of that is common theme.
It's a F-I-L-S?
No, F-I-L.
R-O-U-G-E?
Yeah.
That means, a fil rouge means common theme.
Yes.
Okay. So what's the sentence again?
Literature and the arts, in fact, constitute a sort of constant fil rouge, a constantly unspooling thread connecting in time McLuhan's media explorations. Quote, mosaic or, quote, field approach is the term McLuhan himself employed to define these explorations. Mosaic was also his way of rendering them. And then she does quote.
So that sentence saying that the literary modernism is the roots of McLuhan's mosaic?
Yeah, it's just saying what you just said.
Yeah.
You usually, when I just pick up a quote, you usually explain what she's going to say further on. So, and here, a few sentences later, she says, as Donald Thiel clearly acknowledged in his last book on McLuhan, quote, what remains relatively unlearned from that figure, bracket, McLuhan's image as a media girl or as a pop icon, bracket, with its strengths and weaknesses as a pop poet bridging modernism and postmodernism, comma, is the vital importance of the arts and literature and their history to the understanding of technology, culture, communication, artifacts, and the processes of human perception.
What was the first part? Thiel did that?
Well, I gave the quote about literature and arts constitute the fil rouge, and then there is a sentence that is his writing technique, and then in the following chapters, both these terms will be questioned and explored, and then it goes into, as Don Thiel clearly acknowledged.
Right.
So you're looking for the book?
Yeah, I'm going to get the book, but I had another idea there.
So mosaic field, and then she's saying Thiel acknowledged all this and the importance of the arts and literature.
Now, the mosaic field is a reductionist explanation of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't do much Finnegan's Wake. I don't think she's mastered it enough yet. But McLuhan is translating Finnegan's Wake in all his writings, and Finnegan's Wake is building on Lewis, Pound, Eliot, and Yates. You know, they're the four evangelists on one level in Finnegan's Wake. So how to read Finnegan's Wake, which was the subtitle for the Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media, The Road to Finnegan's Wake. So how do you describe Finnegan's Wake? What are some of the motifs? Well, one of the things is the themes are repeated every page, monotonously, if you notice it. So what's he showing? He's showing the decentralization or the networking of nodes in the electronic and digital medium. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to write about like right now, we're being listened to by people all over the world, so you could have different people sitting in different parts of the world in the audience, and we're signaling to them by taking her sentences and translating them into 35 languages.
Mm.
Now, like, you could show that on a book page that you're doing that, and that's what Finnegan's Wake is. Here comes everybody, have come into the same room. See,
yeah.
Ulysses is about a guy walking around mostly in the daytime. So it's the daylight book, even though there's a lot of it in the end of the night. But Finnegan's Wake is the nighttime book.
Mm-hmm.
So they say it's a guy sleeping. He falls asleep at the end of Ulysses, and then he dreams. So it's taking place. Oh, the whole book of the history of humanity takes place in one room. But if you imagine that everybody is tuned into the room because it's a TV show, and everybody is there discarnately in the room with Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, who's dreaming, sleeping, how do you present that on the book page? And you'll see in her, you're going to find quotes where she says, we take the style of electric media and apply it to the Gutenberg page.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
When you understand that's what Joyce is doing, he's painting the world on all sensory levels, it has to be a book that looks like that. And he has perfect pitch that he solves the problem in the way he presents this technological fact, this discarnate super angelic fact, and puts it in the book form.
Right, and she mentions Finnegan's Wake in the book 22 times.
Yeah, and I didn't find any startling, interesting content analysis other than a general statement like I just made.
Mm-hmm.
She does say that, I think she says that Finnegan's Wake brings the electronic environment to the page.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if she could go into the details like I can with why certain episodes are repeated.
Mm-hmm.
And
the interconnected pattern of forces acting inside the electric word of Finnegan's Wake.
Okay, read that again.
Let me go to the page. It's page 56. And go back one page. Instead, it is a multidimensional poetical attempt to reveal the interconnected pattern of forces acting inside the electric word of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, that's accurate. But how do you show that? To spell that out, like she did, and then understand it, like you're getting the understanding, then show that person who just read that sentence and thinks they get it, a page of Finnegan's Wake, they will say, I can't read that. Because they haven't got the perception developed of McLuhan's message of how McLuhan is translating Finnegan's Wake. So when you fully understand McLuhan, you know how to read Finnegan's Wake. And you know why it's written that way and all the subtleties and variation that go on in it. You understand the chaos, right? I don't see her showing that in detail about a page of Finnegan's Wake like Thiel can do.
Mm-hmm.
Thiel does it in his books.
Right.
Did I hear someone say yeah?
So what she's coming across, though, as a teacher, where Thiel, he was definitely more of an explorer.
Yeah, he was abstract, artistic, intellectual, abstract. I think Lamberti seems to be interested in that kind of art,
mm-hmm.
But she's not that way in her teaching. She's more conventional. She's saying accurately what McLuhan has done.
Yeah.
But I don't know if she ever, I don't think I saw it in her book. I've read the whole book where she quotes McLuhan saying that understanding media or Gutenberg galaxy is the road to Finnegan's Wake. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she does in there, but it's not developed enough.
Well, I don't think that was not the point she was trying to make.
Of so what? Of her book?
What you're saying. She wasn't trying to put it into Finnegan Wake terms. She's just trying to explain McLuhan.
Yeah, but she has to. But she has to deal with Finnegan's Wake, and she does. Mm-hmm. But she lumps him in with the other guys, and they all were doing the same thing. The road to understanding the media environment of their day was their poetry, and their poetry was the page adjusted to movies, radio, and telephones and cars.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jessica Pressman in the Digital Modernism book, you know, makes that a law. Any avant-garde experimental art has to be dealing about the media of the day, the new media.
So here's what she says about part one of the book, what she's going to write. I offer an investigation of McLuhan's form of writing, approached as a systemic cognitive tool through the unveiling of four different masks that through time we have put on Marshall McLuhan: the media oracle, the media guru, the modernist, the media slash techno fan. This investigation cross-reads McLuhan's passion for the humanities in the light of his boundless intellectual curiosity, which embraced literature, the arts, anthropology, philosophy, and the hard sciences and social sciences alike. Now, you could also throw in medicine and what? Chiropractic and yoga.
And the occult.
And the occult. She doesn't put that in there, which we know personally.
Yeah.
So that's what, these masks, has anyone ever gone through those?
No. She's good. That's Quadrophenia.
Yeah.
That's Madison Avenue's categories for the phenomenon of McLuhan.
I even wondered if it could be anything to do with your four bodies, matching up the oracle, the guru, modernist, and the media techno fan.
Okay, the media guru would be the TV body.
Yeah.
And radio back then. The oracle is the first one.
Mystery body.
Yes, or the oral culture of speech. But speech and early humans, okay, the oracular, the rhapsodic, that would be McLuhan the oracle. And then the media guru is the TV guy.
Modernist.
And the fan, that would be maybe the chemical body. Because he's celebrating particular individuals of a kind of creativity, experimental creativity. So that's chemical body brain, right?
Mm.
And he's paying attention to the past like the Gutenberg world does.
Modernist is digital if you just think of modern times.
Oh, no, no. Then the next thing is technology fan, a promoter of new technologies. But everybody's thought like... Remember the guy at the airport when I left the McLuhan Archives? I went back, and he had been looking at it at customs, and then I got it because I had left it there by accident. He said, he goes, so this guy likes TV? That's how he saw it. You know, they put it in a simple term. Oh, this guy is talking about TV, so he must like TV. No clue. No, I should have said to the customs, I know he likes Phineas Wake. He'd go, what? What'd you say? Is that an Arab word, buddy? Okay, you're under arrest. And I would have been slammed down for saying these syllables, Phineas Wake. But I would have then brought my lawyer in and eventually got him to sit down and explain to him Phineas Wake is a book. But it's not really a book. It's a radio program. And McLuhan was a fan of that.
Come
and
on.
He'd go, hey, buddy, you're confusing me. Let him go.
Come
and
on.
I get on the plane.
Come on,
and
come
Carol
on.
Would say, Bob, we had to sit there for 2 hours while you got processed by customs. And everybody would be mad. And then we'd get to L.A.
Okay. So what's the digital body?
And that plane that we flew to, Carol told me not to go into personal stories, but this is a good one, Carol. The plane that we flew that morning, September 1st, 1977, to Los Angeles for your 2 months sabbatical at the UCLA
Pain control
Clinic. On that plane was Flo and Eddie, who played with Zappa,
because
this was 1977. They weren't playing with Zappa anymore, and they were regulars on Canada's Johnny Carson show called Peter Zosky, the late night show. And we had seen them the night before on Peter Zosky's show doing their funny gig that they did that Zosky appreciated. So they had the separate gig on Canadian TV, but they were on the on the plane, and so. I saw them in the waiting room when we were getting on the plane. So I put my bag down, and I went over, and I started talking to them and reminded them of my Zappa world, and they started to sort of vaguely remember me and this and that. And then I turned around, and some lady had tripped and fallen over my bag. So they were looking at that. They probably thought, oh, that's not cool, Bob. You just caused a lady almost to break her head. So anyways, I go over and apologize to the lady and get my bag. So we get on the plane, and they're sitting up in first class. So I walk up to first class before the plane takes off, and I kneel crouch down. I start talking to them about this and that, and about their life with Zappa. And they said something like, "Well, we were on the road for over 2 years." I said, "No, you're not. You were only on for an hour."
An
hour and a half. you were only on there for a year and a bit. And I give them the dates, and they go, "No, that's not right." And we start arguing. So the stewardess comes along.
We start arguing.
And the stewardess comes along and says, "Sir, you're not allowed to sit here in the aisle like this and talk to these guys. So you got to go." And so I said, "Okay, I'll talk to you later." So I get taken, kicked out, and gone back to our economy class.
Bob's always getting kicked out.
Yeah. And so then after we got off the plane, I couldn't find them. They made no effort to talk to me.
They ran.
So they banned me, so I cursed their career, and they went nowhere from that point on. Now, was that too much of a digression, people? Did you like that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right.
So have we done, I don't know if you did.